Welcome back to Pete's Grit. I'm Zach Hodges, a pediatric ICU fellow from UT Southwestern in Dallas.
And I'm Alice Shanklin, a critical care fellow at Children's National in Washington, D.C.
Alice, remind our listeners what we do here at Pete's Grit?
Absolutely. Pete's Grit is an international PICU podcast. We talk to the clinical experts, both in the United States and around the world, about their best bedside teaching points, and we are putting them on the internet for you.
And it's interesting that you say international, because today's guest is Dr. Martin Nijber. He's the chief in the Division of Pediatric Critical Care at the Beatrix Children's Hospital in the Netherlands. His basic science research focuses on ventilator-induced lung injury and its relationship with multisystem organ failure. He is also a principal investigator for PROSPECT, or Prone and Oscillation Pediatric Clinical Trial.
Yes, Dr. Nijber is the expert that we want to be talking to about this. He's not just the PI for PROSPECT. He's published numerous scientific papers, book chapters. He gives international addresses. He gives workshops. He is the medical president of the European Society for Pediatric and Neonatal Intensive Care. And he's a member of the editorial board of Pediatric Critical Care Medicine. We are so excited to be talking with him. And really, I want to lean into the fact that Dr. Nijber transitions to the oscillator a lot earlier than at least you and I do at our U.S. centers. And it was so interesting to hear his robust clinical experience in doing that and in troubleshooting these oscillator problems that are rare for us and common in a unit that uses it frequently.
Yes, I think I learned so much from this episode, this conversation with Dr. Nijber. I think even if we're in centers that don't use oscillator near as frequently, there are so many clinical pearls and take-home points to take away from this conversation. Let's get right to the episode. Welcome back to Pete's Grit, and welcome to the podcast, Dr. Martin Nijber. We are so excited to have you here. To get things started, will you please tell us something about yourself and what you do is related to pediatric critical care and include something you enjoy outside of medicine?
Hi, my name is Martin Nijber, and I'm a pediatric critical care physician in the Netherlands, a very small country in Europe, which probably, well, many of you know and some might not know. It's not Denmark, it's not Germany, which we are often confused for. I'm, since 2014, the division chief of the Division of Pediatric Critical Care Medicine, trained in Amsterdam, became an intensivist in Amsterdam, and then to my current place. And my main focus is, well, pediatric critical care, of course, in general, but I'm very much intrigued by mechanical ventilation, respiratory failure. That's my thing. And outside my work, I do a lot of things. I like to run. I like to do a lot of things with the family. And I collect Lego and the adult things of Lego. You know, the creator sets, the big modular sets.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm really looking forward to the new one coming out in December with the Natural Museum and the dinosaur in it. So that's my thing outside work.
Oh, that's awesome. Now, you have an impressive career in research that includes almost everything in the respiratory care spectrum. How did you get on this path, and what were your key early career steps?
Thank you for your kind words. When I did my fellowship in Amsterdam, it was a very small faculty, but one of the faculty members, he was also a respiratory aficionado. And his enthusiasm about it and about mechanical ventilation and the fact that it's one of the most practiced things in the intensive care unit. But if you're really honest, you would say that many people who use it on a daily basis, well, you could improve on knowledge, how to apply mechanical ventilation. His enthusiasm, and it sparked a fire in me. So we started doing like small projects, like doing Heliox in RSV, low respiratory tract infection on the ventilator. We started playing with the electrical impedance thermography, which is a non-invasive diagnostic tool. You can make some sort of CT images of the chest and the lungs and to see what tidal volume is going, what happens with endexpiratory lung volume. And so it built up, and all with the idea of, okay, we use the ventilator a lot, but it's such a black box. We really need to understand how we are using it, when we should use it in a particular setting, how we should set it, and to understand short and long-term effects, because, well, we know how to adjust it, but what happens with these patients and what happens in the long term with these patients. So that's what really sparked the fire.
Yeah. I feel like instances and experiences at the bedside, trying to figure out exactly what's going on with your patient, it seems to be a theme that powers many of our powerful researchers and some of the individuals we had a chance to interview here on the podcast. We also know that successful careers aren't all one positive experience after another positive experience. And the question that we really enjoy asking is, do you have a favorite failure that you'd like to share with us today? Maybe something that didn't quite go to plan, but still offered a meaningful lesson.
Oh, I have many failures. It started off really good. I was a medical student and I did my research, which was necessary to get my graduation. And we wrote a paper about it. And it was back in 1996 and you had to write it on a computer, but you had to print it out and send it to a journal for review. And 3 weeks later, we got just a short letter back from the journal. This is perfect. We accept it. No changes, nothing. And that was my first manuscript. And then my supervisor said, well, this is very uncommon to happen. So make sure that this is not going to happen the next time. So the paper got accepted without any edits. It was fine as it was. But when we were doing all these small studies and all these small bedside studies, and when we started to develop things in our respiratory physiology lab, I think numerous experiments that we did went completely wrong, gave stupid results, results that we couldn't explain, results that didn't make any sense. Or another one we did, for example, a study with patients where we used EIT during high-frequency recruitment. All the files were corrupt and broken, and the data was really broken. So we, that was a week of frustration and anger and shouting, and then learning, okay, we made these mistakes. Well, we're going to do it again, but now we're going to avoid the mistakes. So it's all with up and downs. And when new students come in and PhD students come in, I always tell them, listen, research is making more mistakes in the beginning than getting good results. But you learn from the mistakes. You learn what you're doing wrong and you have to accept it. That's part of doing research.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, before we get started on the topic, do you have any conflicts of interest to disclose?
Not for this podcast, no.
Great. Alice, give us our case.
All right. So we've got a 2-year-old girl managed in the PICU with ARDS secondary to pneumonia. She is now on day 3 of her hospitalizations, worsening hypoxemia and hypercarbia despite increased ventilator settings, following the ARDS-NET PEEP FiO2 table and intermittent prone positioning. Your oxygenation index is 16, consistent with severe pediatric ARDS. The team is considering converting to high-frequency oscillatory ventilation. So before we get started, what is high-frequency oscillatory ventilation? What are we about to do?
So high-frequency oscillatory ventilation is a alternative mode of ventilation where the device generates a continuous distending pressure, most commonly referred to as mean airway pressure, because the device sends out a continuous flow through the system, a flow that goes somewhere between 20 to 60 liters per minute. And this continuous flow, this mean airway pressure that is generated, that maintains lung aeration. Superimposed on this mean airway pressure are small oscillations at a rate between 3 to 15 hertz. And 1 hertz is 60 breaths per second, so you can calculate how many breaths there are. And these small oscillations, these generate the stroke volume that is for the ventilation. So the oxygenation is maintained through a mean airway pressure, keeping the lung open. Ventilation is achieved through the small superimposed oscillations, the stroke volume. That's the basic concept of high frequency. So in fact, it is a super CPAP device because you can give a really high continuous distending pressure.
I like it as a super CPAP device.
With wiggle, right?
With wiggle, with
<That's>
wiggle.
Right. Give us a bit more insight on the physiologic rationale. Why might high frequency be helpful for some of our critically ill patients in the PICU compared to conventional?
Yeah, that's a very important point. So we all know the concept of lung protective ventilation. We don't want to exceed the plateau pressure. We don't want to exceed injurious driving pressure thresholds. We want to reduce lung stress and lung strain as much as possible. Lung strain is the allowable tidal volume in relation to the compliance of the lung, the compliance of the respiratory system. So at some point, if you have a patient with a very bad lung disease where you cannot achieve adequate oxygenation or ventilation, or at least the targets you want to achieve, without exceeding those limits, if you would exceed those, you enter in an injurious part of the pressure volume loop, over distending patients, causing ventilator-induced lung injury, causing global and regional lung stress and strain. So when conventional ventilator settings become toxic or are approaching the toxic injurious limits, then I think it's the time to think of high-frequency oscillatory ventilation because you have the high mean airway pressure to maintain the lung aerated and the superimposed small oscillations, they generate a stroke volume which is about 1 to 2 ml per kg, lower than that space. So you are really generating very small transpulmonary pressure changes at the alveolar level. So the stress is much lower, at least we assume much lower with high frequency than during conventional ventilation.
And when I kind of reflect on time and training and thinking about bedside teaching on rounds for high frequency, I feel like we've talked about in the past terms like pressure attenuation, where maybe the lower airways don't feel the same pressure that the actual ventilator is generating, so therefore it's protective. And then there's also an aspect of exhalation is active. Will you give us a few comments on those two points?
Yeah, so these are really important components of high-frequency oscillatory ventilation. First, the active exhalation. So what's meant with that concept is that air is not only blown into the patient, but is also actively sucked out of the patient. There are devices on the market that claim to have high-frequency oscillatory ventilation, but they rely on passive exhalation. So the flow stops, but with true oscillatory ventilation, the flow actually becomes negative because it's really sucked out of the patient, thereby preventing air trapping. That's an important concept. Now, with the pressure, and that's, for example, what we see in our unit and which I tell the fellows and the residents and the nurses as well, because when they see this really large pressure swing on the device, they think, oh, this is what's going on at alveolar level. But the compliance and the resistance of the respiratory system dictate how much of the pressure is actually propagated to the lung. So the lower the compliance, the more pressure is seen at the alveolar level. So that's why, and we'll talk probably later on, why you need to recruit a lung. And the higher the resistance, the lower the pressure propagation is. So how much pressure swings generated by the device are actually seen at alveolar level depends on compliance and resistance of the respiratory system.
Yes, all great things to unpack further.
So you've got a piston putting air in and then sucking it out in a way. And you've got differential pressures seen by different areas of the lung. I'm wondering if we could talk about patients with maybe obstructive disease and why they would or wouldn't benefit from the oscillator.
So the general thinking is that patients with obstructive airway disease should not be put on the oscillator because the fear is that with the higher pressure, with the high flow, you would enhance or exaggerate the air trapping. I use it a lot in obstructive patients. So
really?
So let's say the viral patients, they have a restrictive and obstructive lung disease. This is really the example of the patient with the status asthmaticus. So the one with the true airway obstruction. In that case, I use the oscillator, the mean airway pressure of the oscillator, not to open up the lung, but to open up the airway, to splint the airway open. And it's a completely different approach than what you would do with ARDS, for example, because let's say the baseline frequency you start on is also very much lower with asthma than with ARDS. But in ARDS or in diffuse alveolar disease or restrictive lung disease, whatever term you use, mean airway pressure is used to open up the alveolus and maintain the alveolar patency. With obstructive airway disease, the mean airway pressure is used to open up the airway and keep the airway open. And the titration is very much different between the two procedures. So especially with obstructive airway disease, what I would do is when I put a patient on, I increase mean airway pressure, do a blood gas. If CO2 hasn't dropped, I would increase a little bit more the mean airway pressure. Then do another blood gas. And as soon as the CO2 starts to drop, then I stop increasing my mean airway pressure. Because then the airway is open, the air can go in and can go out, CO2 can come out of the patient, but then there is no need to further increase the mean airway pressure because the alveolus is relatively healthy. It's the airway that is affected. The alveolus is relatively healthy, so the alveolus doesn't need the pressure, but the airway needs the pressure. Whereas with ARDS, we found in a study where we characterized all our lung recruitment maneuvers that you really need sometimes to go up to 35, 40 centimeters of water to really open up the lung to really recruit alveoli with ARDS.
That is fascinating and something I've already learned using high frequency, I would imagine, in a very, very sick status asthmaticus.
You've done this too, Zach?
No. I learned something today. No, yeah.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, no, this sounds like you need to be truly a master before you transition this to your intubated asthmatics.
Well, you need to be skilled. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And really feel comfortable and really be careful.
Yes. Maybe if we were to take a half a step back and say we have a critical care fellow listening to us here who maybe doesn't have as much experience with high frequency, can you describe maybe a air quotes here, ideal patient for high frequency oscillatory ventilation in the PICU?
An ideal patient would be a patient where you are at the limits of your conventional ventilator setting. So let's say the plateau of 28, FiO2 of 0.7, 0.8, but the patient is still hypoxic and or hypercapnic. That would be a perfect patient. If you're not on the PROSPECT study, for first randomized, of course, for PROSPECT, but if you are not a PROSPECT site, then this is an ideal patient, ideal candidate for high-frequency oscillatory ventilation, absolutely.
And then do you think about age or body surface area or weight as making you lean one way or the other?
I use it in every patient, let's say the two-month-old viral pneumonia baby or the 16-year-old with severe chest trauma after a motor vehicle accident, for example. But it's controversial, especially in the older group, because of the adult studies. Hey, you know, the adult studies that have shown that high frequency actually caused more harm than benefit. I have a lot of opinion on this quality of these studies, but that's now what the general idea is in the field. Well, high frequency, probably you shouldn't use it, and especially not in the older ones or in adults. There is one inherent design flaw with the oscillator which limits its use in bigger patients, and that is the fixed bias flow. So when you have patients with really bad lungs, you don't want to breathe spontaneously because you don't want to enhance their lung injury. So then the fixed bias flow isn't an issue. But as soon as the patient improves, you want the patient to start breathing spontaneously. That's very easily doable on the oscillator. But the fixed bias flow may cause flow starvation because at some point, if a patient wants to take a deep breath and the peak inspiratory flow of that patient will exceed what is delivered by the oscillator, then the patient will have flow starvation. So that's one of the drawbacks of the oscillator. But then you could argue that as soon as the patient starts to improve and you have weaned your pressure, you could go back to conventional where spontaneous breathing is much more easy. So from my perspective, there is no real restriction in age. A restriction is mainly by the device. The most commonly used device is the device from Vyaire, which is the Sensormedics. They have two types, type A and type B. And type A can go up to 25 kilograms. Type B is for older children and adolescents and adults. I have to admit that I often use the B in even very small babies when they have really bad lungs because it's a more powerful device. But that's not endorsed there by the manufacturer, of course. But the A should, well, in most cases, should be suitable for up to 20, 25 kilograms.
Oh, nice. What about on the cardiac side?
that's a fascinating one because our cardiologists and our surgeons are, well, they hate the oscillator, but we put post-cardiac surgery or the ones who, are, let's say, for example, have a congenital heart defect and now with the viral disease and the viral pneumonia, we put them on the oscillator. And one of our colleagues recently published about this group. She collected data from about 60 patients with pulmonary hypertension, with congenital heart disease, where there is no mixed circulation or where there is mixed circulation, and high-frequency oscillatory ventilation in all those patients. Some of them came in with viral pneumonia, with another cause for respiratory failure. Some come in post-surgery with ARDS. And in all these kids, there was no detrimental effect on hemodynamics. Lactate decreased. They were very easy to oxygenate and ventilate. No increased need for vasoactive support when they were on the oscillator or whatever. So it's even safe in patients with cardiac anomalies.
Wow. So fascinating. It's certainly opening my mind up so much about the potential patients that I'm able to care for with an oscillator. Of course, everything in a system, you have to have the RTs and bedside nurses. Everyone has to understand the mental model that we're treating these patients with. In your practice and your understanding of the literature, would you say there are any absolute contraindications in pediatric critical care for high frequency?
I wouldn't say there are absolute contraindications. I know there are patient populations where it might not be the best option, let's say, but that's very small. Let's say that the patient who comes in with a pulmonary hypertensive crisis because of pulmonary hypertension, they do poorly anyway, but they do also poorly on the oscillator.
Right.
But in fact, any patient can be put on the oscillator. But the most important thing is about education with your whole team, like you were saying. So you need to train your attendings, your fellows, your residents, your RT. You need to do even a simulation because it's not something that you do on a daily basis, the oscillation. And it's really good to have local algorithms that help you define, okay, now that my patient is failing or is not working on the oscillator. One of the keys is not to use it too late, but another key is not to keep on using it when it's not improving. So for example, in our unit, we have the policy that if we have a patient who is, for example, a so-called non-recruiter, so you do a recruitment maneuver, but the patient doesn't seem to improve in terms of lung aeration, which we know happens in about half of the patients with ARDS, then you set your mean air pressure somewhere to balance oxygenation and hemodynamics. But at some point, if the patient doesn't improve over time or the mean air pressure stays really, really high over time, well, then we are going to think, well, maybe, well, we're not going to help the patient with the oscillator in this case. Maybe this is a candidate for ECMO. But I have to say, and that is quite controversial, I know ECMO people don't really like it, but I very rarely need to use VV ECMO because I put all the kids on the oscillator.
So fascinating.
Can you describe again in detail what you mean when you differentiate between recruiters and non-recruiters and what exactly you do to make that distinction?
That's really key because from the outside, you don't know if a patient has a recruitable lung disease or a patient doesn't have a recruitable lung disease. So when we move from the conventional ventilator to the oscillator, we start with a mean air pressure that is about 8 centimeters of water above the mean air pressure that is on conventional ventilation. And that is because the stroke volume with high frequency is so much smaller that if you would start on the same mean airway pressure, the patient would immediately desaturate. And everybody would panic and say, oh, high frequency isn't working. Patient is desaturating. So you have to start on the same entry point of the pressure volume loop. You need a much higher starting mean airway pressure. So we start about 8 centimeters of water above. And then we are going to do a staircase recruitment maneuver. So, and that means that we're going to increase the mean airway pressure by 2 centimeters of water every 10 to 15 minutes. It takes time because recruitment of alveoli takes time. The time constant of alveoli is different across the entire lung. Some open up very early. Some really take some time to open up. It's like an avalanche. You see, when an avalanche starts, the snow isn't immediately down. It takes time before the snow is down. That's the same with pressure and with opening of the alveoli. And from the same study where we characterized the recruitment maneuver, we were able to calculate a time constant, so how soon opens up, in about only a third of the patient. And in, well, our steps were 10 minutes separate. So it means that recruitment takes a really long time, maybe even longer than 10 minutes. But now we've arbitrarily cut it off at 10 minutes. So we increase mean airway pressure, 2 centimeters of water every 10 minutes. And we watch the saturation. Because as we know with high frequency, there is a linear relationship between lung aeration and oxygenation. So we monitor the saturation. And as long as the saturation starts to improve, we keep on increasing the mean airway pressure. So we increase, watch saturation, saturation goes up, and we keep on increasing until the point where the saturation no longer improves and the blood pressure starts to drop. And then you know, okay, at that point, I'm at the upper part of the pressure volume loop. I'm really over the standard now, my patient. So I don't need to increase the pressure anymore. Both mean airway pressures we note on the paper. So we note the mean airway pressure where the oxygenation starts to improve and where the oxygenation no longer improves or the blood pressure drops. Then we decrease the mean airway pressure 2 centimeters of water every 10 to 15 minutes while again monitoring the saturation. And we keep on doing this until the point where the saturation really starts to drop, which signifies the point of lung derecruitment, collapse of alveoli. We note that point again. Then we repeat the whole procedure. And then when we are back on the downward titration, we stop 2 centimeters of water above the mean airway pressure where we found, okay, now is the patient derecruiting. So increase the pressure, saturation goes up, until at some point it doesn't go up anymore, blood pressure starts to drop, decrease pressure, saturation normalizes, and decrease pressure. At some point, saturation starts to decrease, means patient is derecruiting, stopping recruitment, whole procedure again, and then 2 centimeters of water above, we stop. And that is on the deflation limb of the pressure volume loop. The benefit of doing this recruitment maneuver is you oscillate on the deflation limb, meaning that you make use of the hysteresis of the lungs. And hysteresis of the lungs is a concept which I think many fellows will know, but it means that on the deflation limb, you can have a bigger volume for the same pressure or the same volume at a lower pressure. And of course, the more severe the lung is, the more the inflation and deflation are imposed and hysteresis is no longer present, but that's making benefit of the hysteresis of the lungs. And this recruitment maneuver, this takes time. This takes about 45 minutes to an hour. And if you do this recruitment maneuver, you can identify if a patient is a recruiter. Now, let's say you increase the pressure, but nothing happens with the saturation. There is no golden rule, but we have arbitrarily said that if after 5 incremental pressure steps, there is no increase in saturation, that probably means the patient is a non-responder, so a non-recruiter. Patient doesn't have recruitable lung disease. So then we start to decrease the pressure again to do the same like with the recruitable lung. But there we set the mean airway pressure 2 centimeters of water below the mean airway pressure where we said, okay, the patient is not a lung recruiter. And then you balance oxygenation and hemodynamics. Those are the most difficult patients, the one who don't have a recruitable lung disease. And the thing is, it's not static. So we do this recruitment maneuver, especially in the beginning, at a minimum of twice a day, because it could very well be that in the morning the patient didn't have recruitable lung disease, but let's say on later in the day, the patient started to have recruitable lung disease, or vice versa. In the morning, it was recruitable, but in the afternoon, lung disease progressed and the patient became less recruitable. So that's the only way how to differentiate between those two. I mean, there are fancy techniques like the EIT or other stuff, but they are really limited to research setting now at this stage. We do need those devices. That's one of the topics of our research as well, because we need imaging tools to guide the recruitment maneuver. Now, we do this staircase recruitment maneuver because we think it really best meets the individual needs of the patient. The adults used a recruitment maneuver, which is a one-size-fits-all recruitment maneuver. They used the so-called 40-40 rule. So they gave 40 centimeters of water for 40 seconds to open up the lung, and then they set the initial mean air pressure at 30 centimeters of water. They did it in every patient, and well, this is one of the drawbacks of the adult oscillate trial, for example. But that's not just a one-size-fits-all principle, which really doesn't work with precision medicine. And like I said, when we did the study where we really characterized all the recruitment maneuvers, the median or the interquartile range pressures needed to open up the lung was somewhere between 35, 40 centimeters of water. So a 40-40 rule would really cause over-distension in a lot of patients or even still an under-recruited lung in some patients.
Oh, absolutely. I love that this sounds very analytical and also very protocolized in your unit. Is that the case? The respiratory therapists will just do it?
Yeah, it's very protocolized. We have made a special smart form in Epic so that each step, all the data comes in, that you can really determine, okay, is it recruitable or not? Yeah, absolutely.
And I would imagine as your patient's lung disease changes, you'll see that recruitable threshold, you know, maybe as their lungs get worse, it goes higher. As their lungs improve, it drops down. And it's another way to monitor your patients.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. So this is the recruitment maneuver. And then what we do at least twice a day is what we call a MAP challenge, or actively twice a day, we're going to seek the lowest mean air pressure that patient needs. So we're going to do a recruitment maneuver, but instead of going up first, we go down first to see where the patient starts to collapse, because the pressures that are needed, well, they are so dynamic. And we've built such a challenge in as well because we are really good in escalating stuff. I think in particular for high frequency, it is that once you're on, you very hardly come off, because everybody gradually weans it because people feel less comfortable with weaning the high frequency oscillatory ventilation compared with conventional. So that's why we did this MAP challenge as well twice a day.
Well, that's fascinating. And we certainly will reflect much more on your bedside practices taking care of these patients. You know, we mentioned the adult studies oscillate trial a couple of times now. What do you feel like is the best evidence that informs our use of high frequency in pediatric critical care?
Well, that's a big black box. We don't have the best evidence yet. We have a very old randomized controlled trial performed by John Arnold, published in Critical Care Medicine, I think in the 90s of the last century. About 60 kids with ARDS and with air leak. And that study didn't show a benefit outcome. Mortality was the same. The only thing that was notable, that patients who were primarily managed with the oscillator had a lower need for oxygen at 30 days than those who were managed with conventional. Then we have two small studies from Thailand, but were not really designed to test mortality. And we have some observational data from one from the virtual PICU database, which showed more mortality, longer ventilation time with high frequency than with conventional. But that study had some errors in design. They did a propensity matching for the analysis. Propensity matching, I don't know if you know it, but propensity score matching is when you do a retrospective study, there is always confounding by indication. Confounding by indication means the most sickest patient is the most likely to get the intervention. So you need to adjust for that. You can only do it in randomization, but in, of course, retrospective, you cannot. So you can calculate a propensity score, and that score says, okay, how likely is a patient to get the intervention? But to calculate such a score, the team, the researchers, they identify the variables that calculate the propensity score. So you look at your data set and you say, okay, probably this helps you, and this is a variable that's used in decision making. For example, we would do a retrospective study, we would look at pressures, FiO2, that kind of stuff, because these are the variables that help us in the decision making. In the database study that was done by the virtual PICU database, they included, amongst others, the need for renal replacement therapy and whether or not the kid had CPR. There were no data on ventilator settings. There were no data on oxygenation. So data that help you, okay, I'm going to do oscillation or not, they were not in that study. So, and those limitations were partly addressed by Scott Bateman's study published in the Blue Journal, where they did a postdoc or a secondary analysis of the RESTORE data. So they did propensity score matching as well. And in that study, they found that mortality was similar between high frequency and conventional. But those who had the highest likelihood of being on the oscillator, the highest propensity score, they had a longer ventilation time. But so we don't have good randomized control trials. And what it really shows is not that high frequency is bad, but it probably shows that despite the fact that this device is on the block for about 30, 40 years now, or even longer, maybe 50 years, that we still really don't know how to operate it in its most physiologic manner. So it's really the operator that defines the outcome of these studies rather than the device itself. We are now running the PROSPECT study, which is the International Prone and Oscillation Pediatric Clinical Trial in children with moderate to severe pediatric ARDS, which is an OI greater than 12. And children are randomized to high frequency or conventional mechanical ventilation and randomized to prone or supine position. And it's a 2x2 factorial trial, so we can also explore the interaction between positioning of the patient and ventilator mode, with the primary outcome ventilator-free days. And this study is currently running, and well, we hope to conclude it in about 3 years and hopefully provide us at least some answer on is high frequency better or is it similar to conventional or not in terms of outcome.
Oh yeah, and that does sound like a fascinating study, whatever it'll be teed up, because that is a high effort randomized trial.
It's a huge effort to get this study going, and we do an international study, so we are really grateful to all our sites in Australia and Asia and Europe, South America, the USA and Canada, of course, because they are doing all the work. And we have now about 300 patients in, so we need about 300 more. Well, hopefully this gives us some answers, because we still, it's a very important question, because despite the fact that the adult trials challenge the use of high frequency in pediatrics, I think there are many, many people still out there who really cherish this device. So we really need this data.
Oh, absolutely. Especially with strict guidelines about titrating and frequency, things like that, right?
Yeah. So the recruit maneuver we just discussed and the MAP challenge, they are essential components of the PROSPECT study protocol.
You know, reflecting on your description of the literature in pediatric critical care, it just resonates with me with many other topics we've discussed where our patients are so complex and there are so many different factors that affect the care that we give them. It's so difficult to study an intervention like the oscillator, you know, except from a randomized controlled trial that takes a lot of time and a lot of resources.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I wanted to reflect back on your actual clinical management, imagining a patient like our case, parenchymal lung disease, maybe developing ARDS. When do you feel like is the right time to start high frequency? Is it kind of when you're maxed out on your conventional, or do you try to not wait that long?
We have adopted a philosophy of not waiting that long. I mean, there is no data to support it, but I think that high frequency, well, you shouldn't use it if the patient has really bad ventilator settings, really high ventilator settings, then probably if available, you should go for ECMO. What we have in our clinical guideline is when the plateau pressure is about 25 centimeters of water, slightly going towards the 28, the PEEP is 8 or higher, and that's a bit challenging because in Europe, we are not fans of the grid. You could open up the PEEP FiO2 grid, so you could really open up another podcast on that. The FiO2 is 0.6 or greater, then we move to the oscillator. Or if we have a patient, let's say, with a mixed phenotype, so not only restrictive lung disease, but also obstructive lung disease, like the viral pneumonias, pH is about 7.15, 7.20, patient is hypercapnic, that would also be a reason for us to put that kid on the oscillator in combination with the high ventilator settings.
Oh, excellent. We also sometimes do a best PEEP trial. It takes about 5 minutes, but you know.
I was going to say one of the most common things I do on this podcast is display my ignorance. I was surprised to hear that you would sometimes start high frequency as low a PEEP of 8 on conventional. And I would love a few more comments on why is that.
There is no real strong motivation behind it. Otherwise, that I think the grid is very complicated, the PEEP FiO2 grid. Because the PEEP FiO2 grid, although it's the best we have, and I support the current PALIC recommendation is to start on the grid and then do an individual titration. They are not really validated from a physiologic perspective. And I think the grid ignores the fact that not everybody has a recruitable lung disease. So I think the oscillator is much more easy to use than conventional. So PEEP is such a difficult and challenging topic, and how to identify best PEEP, how to set best PEEP. And by going to the oscillator, I don't have to worry about that PEEP anymore. So that's why we made a PEEP of 8. Because we know, probably we can go up with the PEEP, but we know that everywhere across the globe, there is some sort of PEEP phobia. We don't go higher than 10 usually in most PICUs, and we accept an FiO2 of 0.7, 0.8. So that's arbitrarily, we said, okay, let's pick a PEEP of 8. But it could very well be that in some patients we say, well, let's first try a PEEP of 10 or a PEEP of 12 before we go to the oscillator. But we said at some point we need to have some sort of guideline and some sort of indication for the people when they're in the middle of the night. They don't need to think about it. Okay, this is what we have, this is what we agreed upon, let's put the kid on the oscillator.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Pete's Crit. Please remember that all content during this episode is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It should not be used as replacement for medical advice. The views expressed during this episode by hosts and our guests are their own and do not reflect the official position of their institutions. If you have any comments, suggestions, or feedback,
You can email us at pedesgritpodcast@gmail.com or find us on Twitter at gritpeds and at pedesgrit on Instagram for real-time show updates. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review in your favorite podcasting application and share with your colleagues. Also, if you'd like to support the making of the podcast, please see the description for Venmo information and how to become a Patreon. Any donation will be appreciated. Thank you again for listening, and goodbye.